I had a window of a few weeks before the chemotherapy started. I would see if I could still find a fertility specialist, anyone to help me save my chance to become a mother. Time was of the essence and it was ebbing away fast. The operation had been huge, and 2 weeks went by before I could even get myself discharged. While still an inpatient, my surgeon recommended that I see a well-known fertility specialist on the ground floor of the Hammersmith Hospital. My hopes were instantly dashed. He didn't think anyone would be able to find my ovaries, and in any case, he felt surrogacy was too cruel and emotionally challenging for the surrogate mother. I had taken my sister Susie along, and despite her noble offer of her own womb, the fertility specialist told me quite bluntly that nothing could be done. It was the harshness of his tone that was so shocking. I was so distraught, I could hardly walk out of his clinic. I staggered back up to the ward, held up by Andrew and Susie, racked with grief. My children were gone forever, and I was powerless to get them back. Infertility tortured me. Everywhere I looked, on the street or on TV, I saw babies, children, and happy families. Every advert seemed to be about nappies or infant milk formula. Unless I shut myself away from civilization, I was constantly confronted with my loss. There was no escape. The pain of infertility hurt like a knife plunged into my chest. Every day, when Andrew went to work, I lay on the bed and sobbed with despair and grief for the children I was never going to have. My hopes and dreams for the future lay in tatters. I felt empty, shattered. I felt I had died already. Anger built up inside me. I felt violated by the first gynecologist, further admonished by the specialist at Hammersmith, robbed of my femininity, my womanhood, as well as the family I had always wanted. I wanted to sue, but this would be impossible if I wanted to get well. That task alone would take everything I had, allowing emotions to surface. The anger and my deep sadness would not be helpful. Stress, I knew, would potentially make things worse. Chemotherapy is only for a couple of months, to sensitize your cancer cells to radiotherapy, my oncologist had said. So, if it sensitizes the radiotherapy treatment, why is there a gap of a month between the two treatments? Why don't you give the treatments closer together? I asked, confused. It made no sense to me.
Well, you might be right, but for now we don't have the evidence. There have been no trials on using them together. Surely it would be better to combine them. It seemed illogical.
Even though it was a short course of chemotherapy, I lost most of my hair and was violently sick. I couldn't be sure it had shut down my ovaries, but I knew without any doubt that the intense radiotherapy that followed would. When the first rays of radiotherapy had passed through me, effectively wiping out any chance that my ovaries would work again, I had wept on the radiotherapy table. The radiotherapists milled about, unsure what to say to help, offering tissues. "Are you okay?" they had asked. "Of course I bloody wasn't. I wanted to rage, to shout and scream. Do you know what you've done? Murderers! You have killed my future children!" They were only doing their job, of course. It wasn't their fault. Instead, I lay there in silence, tears rolling down my cheeks. My hormones plummeted to zero. I hadn't been warned about that. I plunged from being a hot-headed, hormonal 30-year-old into instant menopause. Few will understand what that's like. It's bad enough for many women when their levels of estrogen dwindle naturally with age. But for a flirty, spirited young female to be stripped of her hormones overnight was nothing short of traumatic. Without any warning, the flashes would set my body on fire at the most embarrassing moments. Every night I was so drenched with sweat that I'd have to rip off the covers and dash to the shower. Ovaries produce not only female hormones, but a small amount of testosterone as well. Because I was such a sporty character, I think I had more than my share. Without my normal mix, my mood was low, my sex drive was understandably zero, and my skin was pallid and dry. In the longer term, my hair might become thin, and I ran the risk of osteoporosis and heart disease. Gloomily, I assumed that as no one had offered me hormone therapy, it meant that I should avoid it. Perhaps the hormones were implicated in driving the cancer. My mother's breast cancer had been estrogen-driven. At least I no longer had periods, but this was no compensation for all I'd lost. My mood was now permanently low. I no longer had any zest for life, no mojo, nothing. Hormones play a huge part in defining who you are as a person. Without them, there was little left of me. When I looked in the mirror, I no longer recognized myself. I vaguely resembled the old Jane, but the person staring back looked different, and I felt different. I was nearly bald and had gained a stone and a half thanks to steroids, several courses of antibiotics, and comfort eating. Where was the upbeat, carefree sailing and surfing chick? Had she gone forever? My relationship with Andrew was thrown into turmoil. We found ourselves in a completely unexpected situation neither of us had prepared for. I knew he was finding it hard to allow himself to get close to me. While I understood, it was incredibly painful to accept. He would say things I found unsympathetic and hurtful, like, "Will you always be resentful and angry?" Well, yes, if you put it like that, I will be. I was upset that he seemed unable to understand or empathize, or to give me the time I needed to overcome the devastating diagnosis. Looking back, I realized that I must have been suffering from a form of post-traumatic stress disorder. I didn't feel that my low mood was in any way unjustified. I had every right to be upset, furious, eaten up with grief. It had a disastrous effect on us as a couple. We couldn't talk about the future. We couldn't make plans. We had no idea what lay ahead. Conversations were stilted and superficial. After a few months, our relationship began to cool and slowly break down. We were having real difficulties. For Andrew, the concept of fatherhood was not paramount. It wasn't woven into his being as motherhood was for me. Thanks to the surgery, sex was not what it had been. Necessarily, there were a few months of abstinence, and when action eventually resumed, it was agony. It was incredibly depressing, but I tried to put on a brave face. I didn't want him to know just how painful it really was. Thankfully, he was a kind and considerate lover, but I had no idea whether it would ever be normal, pain-free and pleasurable again. The doctors assured me that things would improve slowly, but this aspect of our relationship made me incredibly insecure. Why would anyone want to stay with me? In the past, I had never had any trouble getting and keeping boyfriends. I'd been engaged twice. I had never been desperate to be loved and needed. Relationships had been on my terms. But now, all that it seemed, had changed. I was no longer a catch. Instead, I was on the scrap heap, spurned by the opposite sex. I felt despair at how much cancer imposed itself on every facet of my life. It was overwhelming having to deal not just with the illness, but with the emotional and financial complications that came with it. I lied about how I was feeling to keep friends and relatives happy. I listened and allowed others to have a say in my treatments. I constantly worried about keeping it all together in front of everyone, putting on that mask, pretending I was fine, when all I wanted to do was just to cry and turn back the clock. My relationship with Andrew became so difficult that with huge reluctance and a heavy heart, I decided we needed some time apart. I was aware that I was becoming too needy and suffocating with talk of children and a future. He could not see how much I was striving for hope, and he wasn't ready for these discussions. Despite my instinct to stay, I knew I had to find my feet, to find a way to be strong and show I could manage on my own. I was too reliant on him. He had to conclude that he still wanted me in his own time. It hurt me deeply, but once again I found myself leaving a relationship, running away, booking myself on a flight back to Guernsey, back to my island sanctuary. I told him I was going home to my parents and back to work. but I didn't want my parents to see the depths of my grief and despair either. I rented a cottage on my own, resisting their help even though the treatments had made me weak and tired. Being alone did nothing but make my mood sink further. I felt so isolated, so misunderstood. Magnifying my misery, my knee, damaged from a ski accident, now became so painful that I could hardly walk, and the other leg was showing signs of early lymphedema because of all the lymph nodes removed during surgery, a chronic condition that causes swelling in bodily tissues. I was an inflammatory mess, a hormonal mess, my body little more than a scarred piece of wreckage. My whole world had fallen apart. I knew I would never be completely fixed again. I felt lost in a body I no longer recognized, thinking thoughts that had never been there before. I was consumed with grief, not just for the devastating loss of my future babies, but also the loss of myself. I just wanted to die. At my lowest point, I found myself on the phone to the Samaritans. Once I put the phone down, I felt ashamed. How had it come to this? Was I truly suicidal? I could never subject my family and friends to that kind of pain. No, I gave myself a stern talking to. Self-pity was no way to get better. Where was Jane, the fighter? The woman I had been before cancer? Was I really going to let this kill me? Would that incompetent specialist win? I needed to find something in my life that gave me joy. I needed meaning and fulfillment. I tried briefly to go back to work as a physiotherapist, a job I used to love. But now patients whinging over the most trivial problems just irritated me. My compassion had vanished. I had stupidly thought the job might help distract me, but how could I be sympathetic about a sprained ankle when I was dealing with cancer? It was hopeless. I quit, and instead focused on selling Bathrobics, a fun bath time exercise book I created before becoming ill, which so far had been selling well through bookshops and the Innovations catalogue. The book turned into a flip chart that stuck over the side of the bath with a rubber sucker. This novel and practical design proved very popular. I turned my energies to promoting it and driving up sales. Ironically, I had just started writing a new exercise ritual for pregnant mothers when I'd become ill. I made the decision to finish it and publish it before the end of the year, torture though it was. I was determined to find a way to be a mum and vowed that one day I would give Bathrobics for pregnancy to a surrogate carrying my baby. I would make it happen. It was the only way I could handle the pain. There was still little joy in my life. Fortunately, my passion for sailing and the sea came to the rescue. I went out sailing in the evenings in Guernsey and travelled back to the UK at weekends to race with Assuage. Gradually, I felt my inner strength returning. I was getting fitter. At long last, a doctor prescribed some hormones to replace those I had lost. I began feeling more like the old me. Andrew started to see that I was still the same person underneath the misery, and that the grief-stricken creature before him was, deep down, still the woman he loved. After sailing one day, he took me out for supper. "It's going to take a while to get you back up with all engines firing," he said. "But I'm here, right by your side, to help you through all this. I believe in you, and I love you. I really want you to come back to London and live with me." I cried with relief. Thank God. I wanted to forget about the cancer so badly, to move on with my life, to patch up my broken body and fix what I had lost. But losing my fertility was beyond my ability to fix, and the subject of children was still hanging between us. I continued to cry every single day, on my own, when no one was looking. When I went for checkups, it was hard to hide my feelings and my grief. The medics were understandably concerned for my mental health. They offered me Prozac, but I refused. No antidepressant was going to hand me back my fertility or cure my lymphedema. So instead, they sent me to counselling. I was doubtful that this would help, but willing to give it a try. The therapist listened to my problems, occasionally offering the odd platitude, but her main job during these sessions was to supply endless tissues as my grief came out in